From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour. I'm Mark Fisher from the Washington Post, sitting in for Kodjo Namdi. We're here on the Politics Hour with Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst. He's also a columnist with the Current Newspapers. And we'll be talking this hour with Ike Leggett, the Montgomery County Executive, and with Paul Wiedefeld, the Chief Executive of Metro. But first, Tom Sherwood, the race for mayor in the District of Columbia, not much of a race as yet, but just this morning, Vince Gray, the former mayor, put out a press release about the situation at United Medical Center, hospital that closed its obstetrics unit amid considerable controversy. A new report citing confidential documents obtained by the Washington Post says that the hospital was planning to shut down that obstetrics ward even before the crisis that ostensibly had led to that. And now Vince Gray is saying he wants to issue subpoenas and he wants to do an investigation. Is he just running for mayor, or is there something more going on there?
I don't doubt that Vince Gray is very worried about the health care or lack of it east of the river in this city. Everyone should be. And I believe he's serious about it. Whether or not he can convert any of this into a campaign for mayor, we don't know. He always starts his campaigns for mayor late. I suspect it'll be late January, even early February, before he gets in, if he does get in. But there's no doubt that, as Peter Jameson at the Post and other people have been reporting, that hospital is not working. Obstetrics is a serious issue. There are hundreds of women who've had babies there, can't have them there now. And it's a crisis that the mayor here on this program a week ago said that they were working on it. But there's been a lot of working on it at that hospital. I'd like to see some action.
After our program today, you'll be heading down to Richmond for the ritual celebration of Jackson Lee Day, or do you have a different agenda?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm actually going to go. Ralph Northam's going to be sworn in tomorrow. It's apparently a rainy morning, and we'll see what the parade's like. I'm going to talk to people in Virginia about the change. We've gone from Ralph Northam is the more modest, mild-mannered politician. He's replacing Terry McAuliffe, who just in the last 24 hours said if he were confronted with Trump situation like Hillary was, that he would deck him. So the change in Virginia is significant, because not only because the House now is 51-49 Republican when it used to be 66-34, but they've got a lot on their agenda, including dedicated funding for Metro, which we'll get into in a moment.
And in Richmond, obviously, a change of the guard from Terry McAuliffe to Ralph Northam, but this occasions a lot of discussion about Terry McAuliffe's legacy. And he's getting good grades even from Republicans in the legislature, at least on the way out the door. He didn't get a lot of compliments while he was in office. He never did get his number one priority through, the expansion of Medicaid, but he'll probably go down in history most for having restored rights to thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of felons. What's the bottom line on how Terry McAuliffe did as governor?
Terry McAuliffe, when he does sit here, he'll give you endless statistics. Employment, jobs, you name it, he does the statistics. Many people think he's trying to see if he's going to run for president. What he's going to do is what he did before he ran for governor. Before he ran for governor the second time, he went around the entire state supporting Democrats in various races, getting known. And then when he ran for governor, he wasn't really challenged. He is going to spend 2018 particularly going around the country helping Democratic governors, and in some cases senators, trying to help build the Democratic Party on a national level. And then after that, he will see whether he can make a campaign or run for president. Or he could also be somebody's pretty good vice president. If you have a more progressive person as presidential candidate, he could be kind of a Lyndon Johnson type person on the second half of the ticket.
And speaking of elections, this is an election year in Maryland as well, and a new poll has Governor Hogan with an approval rate of 71%, really quite extraordinary for a Republican in a state that is 2-1 Democratic in registration. But he's heading now into a politically fraught legislative season, and of course, his own battle for re-election. The same poll found him well ahead of every possible Democratic challenger.
That's true. Mr. Hogan has done what a lot of Republican state officials haven't done. He has steered away from President Trump, and his poll numbers show it. Now, Ike Leggett will be on this program a bit later. Ike told me in December that Larry Hogan has done a good job for the state of Maryland. He's going to be tough to beat. And this is, and Ike used to be the head of the Maryland Democratic Party.
Well, let's welcome in now our guest, Paul Wiedefeld, General Manager and Chief Executive Officer of the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year. And you can join our conversation by calling 1-800-433-8850. Let us know how Metro has been serving you of late, what you think of the efforts to bring it back to speed. And Paul Wiedefeld, obviously, you have been at the helm of trying to restore back to good, as Metro calls it, a massive reconstruction effort, and now a new development in which you're actually proposing to give money back to people who are dissatisfied with Metro's service. And some people are saying, hey, this is great, I'm going to get a whole bunch of money. Others are saying, well, maybe I'm not going to get very much, and this is kind of a PR stunt. Well, what's the real motivation here, and how much recompense can people expect for their troubles?
It's really two things. One is we want to communicate to the entire community that the system is performing much better than maybe sometimes people think. And so we've done a lot of work over the last 2 years to get it to that stage where we have confidence in the quality of the service we can provide. And now we're in effect putting dollars, in our what we're putting out there. And so that's what the program does. It says that basically during the rush hour periods, if you're more than 15 minutes late on your trip, that you don't have to do anything. We will send you literally every night. We will print out a report that shows anyone. You have to sign in. You have to register your card so we know the card. And then basically we're going to run a report, and anyone's trip that took 15 minutes more than it should have, they'll get a notice that says we apologize for what occurred yesterday. And in short order, you'll get a credit to your account. In effect, whatever the trip was, up to $6, whatever the trip you took was.
What I don't quite understand is you have to have a smart card in order to ride the rail system, which is good. But when you say you have to register your smart card, if you just the mere ownership of a smart card won't do it, what do you?
No, because there's no way for us to contact you.
So how do you register your smart card?
You go to our website and you register it. And really, people should be doing that anyway. The reason is the smart card is like cash. So if you've got $50 on it, if you lose your smart card, you're out of $50. If it's registered, we basically cancel that out and credit your new card that we would send you.
And you can do this online.
Just do it right online, and it's very simple. Very simple.
So dedicated funding for Metro has been, I imagine, the number one goal of your tenure so far, and it looks like maybe the stars might be aligning at last. All three major jurisdictions may be on board for funding the system in this big way. How confident are you that this is now going to happen, and how what are you willing to do to make it happen?
I think I'm sure it has a few more chapters to be written to get to that. But I think really what it reflects is, a decades old plus, and Tom can weigh on that, it's been talked about for years. It's been known as something that's needed. So then we go through an annual process of hat in hand to try to get dollars to keep a major capital investment in working order. So I think that the region as a whole, the business community, the riders, the political side of it, elected officials, understand the importance of this system to the region. We've seen what occurs when we don't maintain it. The reality is we're now 40-plus years old, and infrastructure does wear out, and it's a national issue. You see it playing out here, obviously, in our backyard. And the alternative is not good. This is the, unfortunately, the third-year anniversary of a tragic incident on the system, and we have to maintain the safety of the system and invest to keep the system safe and reliable.
Just to follow up, what recourse do you have if you don't get that money? You've said on a number of occasions that Metro has sort of hit a wall and you don't want to cut service anymore and you don't really want to raise fares. So what recourse do you have? I mean, would you
quit over such an impasse?
I'm very committed to the job, so that's not the issue. The real issue is what is probably a little different than maybe in the past is we've made a commitment to for the safety of the system and the safety of the riders. So we will not back off of that. I cannot, and our management team cannot back off of that, and no one should. So the level of investment that we're talking about is to keep the system safe and reliable. So we will continue to do that. So that leaves very few options for us but to turn to. We will continue to manage internally as tight as we can, but the scale of the numbers that we're talking about, you just can't get there from here. We cut $100 million last year. We have to come up with another $42 million this year, for instance. But that's, you know, it's going to be smaller and smaller what I can do internally. So that then does lead you to, all right, now what else can we do? You have to look at service. And what that would mean is you'd have to look at the levels of service, the frequencies of service, the hours of service, and things of that sort, the routes. And then eventually you'd have to look at fares because that is the major revenue source that we get. Those are the only two other options we have if we don't get additional dollars. But we cannot make the mistake that that has been made across the nation in some regards where we keep pushing off until the point where we cannot push it off and we put people's lives in danger. We're not going to do that.
Tom, you could end up being a rush hour service. You could have rush hour service in the morning and the evening. That would be it.
Again, we'd have to look at service across the board because we'd have to come up with the dollars to maintain the
capital. Let me get back to the politics of what's happening with Maryland historically now that all three jurisdictions have some kind of dedicated funding before the legislatures. You've been the good cop in this by trying to do a good job. Jack Evans, the chairman of the council of the Metro Board and a member of the D.C. Council, has been railing against Maryland and Virginia publicly. Larry Hogan has called for him to step down or resign. Terry McAuliffe in Virginia said Jack Evans is an impediment to a decision, not a path. Do you think his being the bad cop played any role in the sense that he kept hammering on Maryland and Virginia that stop asking us to improve management, you've got to provide funding so we can improve management? What role did the chairman of the Metro Board play?
I think the chairman's played an important role as well as the entire board. This board over the last 2 years has dealt with extremely difficult issues. They've had to make some very difficult calls. They've also have been very supportive of the initiatives the management's trying to do to get us to where we need to go. So I think that across the board, the board has stepped up to deal with that. Clearly, there's a certain view of the board that is out there that's not my lane, but it is out there clearly, and that's got to be addressed in some fashion. But the board members that we have are that I've been dealing with have been very committed and have been very supportive and have had to make very very difficult decisions.
The future of the metro system is, as I was checking, in 2019. Which is not that far away in planning purposes, you're supposed to bring back late night service. Do you think you're on track to do that, or is that still an open question?
Actually, what we do is at the end of that period, we are to report back on how we are performing in terms of preventive maintenance and inspection and what that program shows us. Because the commitment was, we started in July when we finished SafeTract, is we had not had a preventive maintenance and inspection program in this agency for 40-some years. Okay. And so we wanted to implement that. So, and literally, there's six different things that we're looking at that literally we need time to do. One without getting too far in the weeds, one is called Megarin, literally where you take the cables off and you run power through it to make sure it isn't leaking somewhere. Well, you can't do that. And obviously, with trains running, you need time to do that. So we want to see what the condition of the system is. And so as a staff, we will come back to the board and say, this is where we are. Either we need these more hours or we don't. The goal, obviously, is to get more service out there. But if we can't do it safely, our recommendation, obviously, would be that we not go back there. But it's too far. You know, it's still where.
So basically, no one should be holding their breath for late night service to be restored.
I think what we should all be going towards is let's get the system safe. And once we're comfortable with that, then we'll work on hours and service.
Let's hear from Rachel in the district. Rachel, you're on the air.
Awesome. Thanks. I'm from Colorado, but I grew up in the district and I love public transportation. And so I've been back for a couple months. I've been very disappointed in not just the single track, but the sustainability measures of what's happening with Metro. For example, just 2 days ago, I took I was getting on a train and It went just one stop. I was supposed to go all the way to the end of the line, to the green line, toward Greenbelt, and just went out of service after one stop. And everybody had, I mean, it was a packed train. Everyone had to get off. So you've got, like, the energy resources that are being utilized from a sustainability factor, the financial sustainability of having to pay. You know, customers have paid, people get frustrated, they leave Metro, they go take a Lyft, or they walk, or find some other way because they don't want to wait for that next 15-minute or 9-minute train. So I'm wondering, on the safety measure, when you have people stepping on and off the train because of a service, train out of service issue, how is Metro thinking to respond to that? And I'm coming from a sustainability...
Right. Well, let's give Paul Wiedefeld a chance to respond. And a lot of nodding heads here in the studio. Everybody's had that experience of, you know, you're forced off a train, or the sign says a train's coming in 5 minutes and it happens in 18 minutes. What should people be doing about with their frustration on this?
Sure. Rachel, I apologize for that, what we call an offload. And it's one of the experiences that we never want to have, but unfortunately we do. What we've done to reduce that, we've actually reduced it by 45% year over year. And the first thing we did was to get some of the oldest cars and poorest performing cars off of the system, the 1000 series, which were literally 40 years old, and the 4000 series, which never performed. We've replaced that now with the 7000 series. That does not mean we will not occasionally have issues. Cars will have issues at time, but we focus on the maintenance of it. We've developed a program. We looked at what are the things that cause the offloads, and some of the things are the doors, for instance, the brakes, you know, just things that pop up. We've done significant work there to reduce those numbers, not where we want to be. I understand it. I unfortunately had one myself just 2 days ago with a door issue. But I did time. It was kind of interesting. I was actually coming from Union Station. I got offloaded at Judiciary. The operator was very good, made frequent announcements, said she was going to get off the train, go to the third door, which is the one that was having the issues, couldn't get it to work, came back in, and she said, "I'm sorry, we have to offload you." And in 37 seconds later, a train came behind us and picked us up. So it does occur, and for that moment, it's extremely frustrating. I get it. But we continue to improve on that, and that's one of the reasons why we were making this rush hour promise, so that when that does occur, at a minimum, we should give you your dollars back.
Listen, I want to go back just briefly to the refund issue. I was looking at, it says that maybe you think you might have to pay out $2.5 to $3 million in refunds. That's out of a $1.5 billion operating
budget. $1.8
billion. $1.8 billion operating budget. So it's not really a lot of money. You're running ads. I watched Morning Joe this morning on MSNBC. I saw a Metro ad, Back to Good. It's Mark's original question. This is part of a public relations, I mean, because it's not that expensive in the grand scheme of things, but a public relations thing to say to riders, we are trying. Is that right?
It's that, and again, that we're much more confident that we can deliver, and we're holding ourselves accountable, and we want to let people know that that's what we do. We couldn't do this 2 years ago. We couldn't have been. The PR part was not worth it, right? We would not have been able to meet it. So it's that we have the confidence that we can deliver it, and we want to hold ourselves accountable to deliver it.
That's Tom Sherwood and Paul Wiedefeld. Paul Wiedefeld is the chief executive officer of the Washington Metropolitan Area. Transit Authority, Metro, and I'm Mark Fisher. This is the Politics Hour. Metro launched this campaign a little more than a year ago to improve service, win back customers' confidence, the Back to Good program. The numbers do show, as you said, that there's been improvement in things like on-time trains, but that's not what customers say they're experiencing. And according to Washington Post poll in December, there's still a sense out there that things are not working. Why is there that disconnect?
It's probably a combination of things. there's a long history here. When I first took the job, I was amazed how Metro was constantly a topic. I was told very quickly that it's in this region, it's the Redskins and it's Metro, that people relate to. So it is the,
we're bound together in our pain.
Yeah, that's right. No, but it is something that clearly is on people's mind. what we're trying to do is to communicate that, yes, with that out there, that perception in some cases, but the reality is that some of the numbers, and the numbers are showing that these things are better than maybe people think. But that's not that's our problem to solve. We got to bring people along because it's been a long road that led us here.
You have, I think, a 4-year contract. Is that correct? Is it?
Yes, I do.
And you're in the midpoint of that now. Is that right?
Yes.
And I think I heard you say you're in for the long term. Mm-hmm. You anticipate, barring something unforeseen, that you'll be here beyond this 4-year contract.
I serve at the pleasure of the board.
So. I did find out that you've made a personal commitment to this. I know your salary is about $400,000 a year, but for 2 years in a row now, and you've just done it again, you've given up an annual bonus of about $80,000. Is that true? And if so, why?
It's not. My salary is obviously very. It's a very good salary. It's. And we have a lot of work to do, and none of our employees non-unionized employees have gotten a raise in 3 years.
I have the number right. It is roughly $80,000 for each of the 2 years.
Again, it's my current contract is for the amount you mentioned.
Let's hear from Ali in Washington. Ali, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. We have metro in New York, in London, in Paris, in Moscow, Tokyo, and I have lived in some of these cities. The ridership is, in some of these cities, over 1 billion. The size of the service area is perhaps 20 times more than Washington, D.C. I really appreciate this gentleman taking his salary off or giving me a refund. I really don't need any of this. I need a ride to the place that I work. What is it with Washington Metro? And I've been using it for 25 years. What is it with Washington that doesn't work? I mean, you go to London, and we're talking about a technology that is 200 years old. You basically have to, it's a train. You got to pick up people from point A and take them to point B. What is it with Washington Metro that can't get it right?
Similar is probably more to New York, Washington. They're going through similar things. And London did, by the way, as well about a decade ago. And all of these major systems have the same core issues, which is it takes a lot of investment to maintain the system, whether it's the power, whether it's the track, whether it's the systems. All those things take money, and they take time. And it's a particular issue in our location where we have a two-track system, and there had been pressure over the years to provide more and more service and not impact that service level. And by doing that, we were pushing off things that had to be done to the point where they started to deteriorate around us. So we see that we saw that with the power, particularly the power issues that we were having, with the cabling issues. We saw it where we had ties literally that were deteriorating under the tracks that did not happen overnight. That happened over years to the point where we had to do 3 years worth of work in 1 year just to try to catch up so that we could start to maintain it on a regular basis. So unfortunately, that is what got us to where we are, and we're not unique. You've seen it in New York has done it. Again, London did it about a decade ago. San Francisco, they've just passed a multi-billion-dollar investment just for those issues. For any of these systems are that of our age, that is a reality. I just happened to meet yesterday with the Minister of Transportation from India, and they have over 700 kilometers of metro that they're building, and they're in the 5 to 10 year range of things that they have on board. And that was the one thing he asked is, you know, how do I start to prepare for this? And I said, well, the reality is you have to prepare for this now. You have to build this into the tough decisions that have to be made, the investment that has to be made. It's one thing to build it. That's the relatively easy part, believe it or not. It's the ongoing maintenance and operations that drive these systems.
We subsidize highways. We subsidize all medical care. We subsidize any number of things in this country. We have yet to learn that we have to subsidize rapid transit without a huge political fight.
That's true.
And as long as we're being fair here, and a lot of the callers do have specific complaints, but we also have an email from Joshua who says, I think Metro's doing a great job. The rush hour service is on time and not overly crowded. The Metro bus and subway operators are generally friendly and respectful. I think Metro gets a really hard rap for performing an extremely difficult task. Similarly from Todd, an email saying he's an Orange Line Blue Line rider, and he's been very impressed with Mr. Wiedefeld's efforts over the last 2 years. I was willing to take on faith the safe track work as long as the other side was as promised, and it has been. I had a total of 3 delays of over 15 minutes. So his question is there a way to consolidate voting across jurisdictions to determine if riders and residents are really willing to raise funds for capital improvements? Do you have the political will out there? Has anyone in Metro tried to move beyond the board and the governors and actually take it to the people and say, are you willing to pony up for the improvements we need?
I think indirectly that is what's occurring when you see the what's happening in Annapolis, Richmond, and the district. I mean, these are elected officials that are basically coming out and dealing with this issue, and I think it is the first time in decades that all three entities have put something on the table and is working through their process. So I'm sure there's, again, lots of negotiations and things that will occur, but to be at this point compared to where we were a few years ago, to have this level of activity around trying to solve this issue, I think is very encouraging.
Yeah, but in Virginia, the Dillon rule is that the Northern Virginia communities, even if they wanted to do a lot more, everything they do, particularly with transportation, is subject to the General Assembly. So it's not like they can act on their own.
True. Let's hear from Carolyn in Friendship Heights. Carolyn, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'll preface my comment by saying, as a transplant from Los Angeles, I do appreciate the Metro system and I'm very thankful for the infrastructure that we do have here. However, as a daily rider for about 9 months last year on the Green Line, the Georgia Ave Petworth station is what I came in and out of on the Metro system daily. And on an average day, I would see between 4, 5, 6 individuals passing through the handicap terminal without paying their fare. And I'm wondering what Metro is doing to address that problem and how widespread that problem was, because it appeared to be widespread at that station last year.
Thank you, Carolyn. That is an issue. We estimate it's significant, double-digit millions of dollars lost in revenue. So we've actually initiated a program to deal with that. We will be, in effect, locking all those gates, what we call swing gates. They were there for moving equipment in and out, and over time, they have become one of the means for people to go in without paying. So we will be locking those. There will be, in effect, emergency gates, and we have stepped up our enforcement. We think it's important that when we're asking for the community as a whole to come up with more dollars, that we do everything we can to obviously keep costs down, but also to increase revenues. And I think it's fair to everyone in the community, for those that pay, that everyone should pay to come into the system.
Would it help if you, in those glass enclosures where the employee, Metro employee sits, I've always thought, why not take that glass down and make them more interactive with the customers come and go. They sit in there. You have to talk through an antiquated little sound system to speak to them. It seems that they're not really there to help the customer.
I agree. I see that sometimes, Tom, as well, and I confront it when I do see that. But we have a lot of stations that are very active, very personable with the people. They constantly go out to the machines and help people. So I think for sure that you see that sometimes. But by and large, our station managers do an excellent job. And remember, they're not just doing that job. They're monitoring lots of other activities that go on at the station. So when you see them in there, that's what they are doing.
And not Walmart greeters.
Right. Well, one of the things that they are at least potentially responsible for is helping with safety. And this is a concern that a number of listeners have raised. A story came out today about testimony in a case of a woman who was raped at knife point in 2016 at 9 a.m. on a moving Metro train. How could this happen in broad daylight? And, you know, obviously this isn't going to make people feel particularly safe off hours. What's been done since then to make the train safer?
Yeah, it's obviously a terrible tragedy, that unfortunate event. But it is something that actually Part 1 crimes are down about 18% year over year.
And those are serious felonies.
Yes, exactly, the type of felony that would fall into. We have emergency call buttons and things of that sort. We have tremendous closed-circuit television now. But we're also asking the community, if anyone ever feels threatened in any way or sees something occurring, please let us know immediately, because we have the technology to get on top of that very, very quickly. So that we will continue to do that. Obviously,
one quick question on buses, because you know buses are so important. There's a plan to reroute, redo the whole bus system for riders. What should they watch for? Can they be part of that? What's going to happen if you try to make the bus system more efficient, serve more people?
Yeah, we're just starting that process, Tom. It will take a good year or two to work through that. We're looking at other models. Houston's done it. I just recently met with Carolyn. Just talked about Los Angeles. I just met with the person that's running that in Los Angeles. But I want to look at it more than just the routes. I think we should look at the entire business model of the bus operation. I think that's worth considering as well.
That's the voice of Paul Wiedefeld. He's the general manager of Metro. We're joined now in studio as well by Ike Leggett, the Montgomery County executive. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be back. And let me say that I think Paul has done a terrific job. He has one of the most difficult jobs, not only in this region, but in the country as a whole. And I think that he has recognized a number of deficiencies and outlined a plan that I think can make this system really, really improve.
Well, and on that note, what has been the impact of Metro's woes on Montgomery County, and how confident are you that the urgency of Metro's troubles is being felt in Annapolis and that the money that Metro needs will now be forthcoming?
Well, first of all, yes, it is a challenge for us in Montgomery County along the red line, because the heart of our economic development and growth is along that red line. And we've had some disruption, but I think when you look at whether or not we should have moved in that direction, I think ultimately the question was correct, that we should have done that. It was disruptive to some degree, but you have to think about the long haul, and he made the right decision in terms of trying to wrestle with this. There are some concerns in Annapolis to make certain that we get behind the system here to try to provide the appropriate financing. I've stated for a long period of time that I believe that we should have a regional sales tax. We should do it aggressively, and we should do it soon. Because for us in Montgomery County and for this region, we need Metro and we need it running efficiently. And it does, in fact, need a long-term financial stability.
Virginia says no to a sales tax.
I understand that, but are you asking me what I would do? I'm telling you what I would do.
And before we let Paul Wiedefeld depart, County Executive Ike Leggett, do you have a question you've been dying to ask the head of Metro?
Well, I think the question would be the turnaround at White Flint. And when we can address that issue fairly quickly.
Yes. This is the Grosvenor's turn back, basically. And it is something that that we are looking at. It's unfortunately a capital. It would require some capital investment, but we are committed to basically exploring that and getting to that as soon as we can.
Do you mind, before Mr. Wiedefeld leaves and while Mr. Leggett's here, and while you're here, can we address the Trump matter, what President Trump said? And the reason I ask, because you wrote the book Trump Revealed in 2016. You're a member of the Washington Post. This horrific word that the president used, I'm not going to say it. I don't think anybody here is going to say it. I want to know what Ike Leggett, as an elected official, thinks. And Mr. Wiedefeld runs a diverse transit system for a diverse community, thinks. I want to know what you think about all the media people saying the word. And while we have you all here, I'm going to seize the host moment and ask all of you to comment on this, because it's a horrific level here in this country, and I want to hear from you.
Well, you know, we're seeing just this morning now a whole new vocabulary that has been inserted not only into the media conversation in this country, but to the language of diplomacy and politics around the world. I mean, just in the last hours, we've seen nations in Africa and in Europe putting out diplomatic statements and press statements using that word, which is just mind-boggling. But from a media perspective, the conversation at the Washington Post was really quite short yesterday. This is something the President of the United States said, and therefore we have an obligation to let our readers know that he's using this kind of language.
Is there a tendency that the media will overplay its hand and will just just become a corpus in the community?
Yeah, I mean, there's always the danger that it's used for sensationalism. We're sitting here and then, you know, CNN on the screen, they've had that word on the screen pretty much around the clock. So there's a certain amount of sort of looking for clicks that might be involved there. But I think the much more important thing is we have an obligation to the people who read the news on our site and in our newspaper to be straightforward and say, this is what the President of the United States said. We're not doing this for sensational reasons. We're doing it to reflect the reality of who's in the White House and what he does.
D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine was on the CNN or one of the cables this morning because he is from Haiti. So back to the public officials here. We'll start with you, Mr. Leggett.
But not just as a public official, but just as an American and a person who happened to be a person of color, this is deplorable. This is unacceptable. It's not just the words. It is a series of words and a series of statements over a number of months. Just keep in mind that he referred to Haitians a few months ago as nothing but people with AIDS. He suggested that the Nigerians should go back to their huts. And now he's used this word, among other things. It is the attitude, it is who's speaking the words, and it is how he reflects this to his base and other people. A comment came out later from the White House that the words, unfortunately, will not, in fact, deter his base. That may be correct, and that's even sadder.
And Mr. Riedefeld, you deal with a diverse population and a diverse community.
My management approach and what I expect from everyone that works at Metro is mutual respect, and that is what we always focus on.
Thanks for coming in, Paul Wiedefeld, the general manager of Metro. We heard from our temporary guest host, Tom Sherwood, there.
I apologize.
No problem. And of course, Ike Leggett, the Montgomery County executive. I'm Mark Fisher from The Washington Post. And since we were just talking about Metro, Ike Leggett, this dedicated funding, it's only going to happen, I would imagine, not only if he gets support from lawmakers in Annapolis, but from Governor Larry Hogan as well. What's your sense of his support for Metro?
Well, I think overall, he understands that Metro is important to this region and also to the state of Maryland. Without Metro, it will adversely affect certainly the Washington region, and that will have a negative effect on the state as a whole. This is the economic engine of the state, I think, in Montgomery County. I think what we have to do now is come up with a series of acceptable alternatives if people do not believe that the sales tax is viable. But in the long run, I think that he is committed to assuring a Metro, and I look forward to his response to how we're going to do that. I've given my position as to how I think I would go about it, but I'm open to other ideas as well.
This is a politics hour. I interviewed one of my last stories on Channel 4 was in December the 14th at the Committee for Montgomery County. 800, 900 people gathered. Eight of the Democratic candidates for governor, now down to seven, were talking, and they were all criticizing Governor Hogan. You told me on camera, to my shock, that you thought Governor Hogan had done a good job in the state of Maryland, that it would be very difficult for any of the Democrats to beat him in the November fall campaign. You're not only the county executive, you're the former state party chairman for the Democratic Party. And I said, well, I think that quote might end up in a Hogan advertisement. But this is the beauty of you're not running for office. You can say what you actually think. What about that? I mean, the Democrats now are down to seven candidates, but you think Hogan, with the 71% approval rating that Mark mentioned earlier, it's a tough slog.
I think I also said that he was not beyond being beaten. But I did say that when you look at the polls and look at his overall approval rating, that he is given a very favorable position. I think that's what I stated. And he will be very difficult to beat. And I don't think that the Democrats disagree with that. It doesn't mean that he cannot be beat, but clearly this is going to be a very formidable task. You're talking about someone now with a 71% approval rating. You're talking about someone who leads internally all of the Democratic prospective nominees. But I think at the end of the day, when you sit back and look at what Democrats have to offer, and we boil it down to one candidate, ask me that question a little bit later on.
Of course, it's worth noting that at the same stage, yeah. Governor Bob Ehrlich had 58% approval rating, and he lost.
Yeah. This is 71%.
Yeah. Rashern Baker earned a lot of money at two fundraisers in the district this week, and you have said kind things about him. You've done everything but stop. You've stopped just barely short of an endorsement of him. Chris Van Hollen has endorsed Baker. Brian Frost, the Attorney General, has endorsed Baker. You've semi-endorsed him. Where are you?
Stay tuned. soon. We'll have an announcement coming out pretty soon.
Oh, you've said that for 2 months.
the announcement this week that the Discovery Channel would be leaving Silver Spring obviously rocked the supporters of downtown Silver Spring, which has gone through such a transformation. They've described it, and you've described it, as a punch in the gut. Was this a surprise to county officials, and who's to blame for their departure?
First of all, it was not an ultimate surprise. We've been working on this literally for the last 9 months to a year. You have to keep in mind that what has happened now is that the business model that Discovery has followed as it relates to television primarily has significantly changed. And so they're looking to develop a new model that hopefully will allow them to move forward, because so many young people and lunch people are not watching television today. And so they've purchased some assets that they think will be much more productive for them going forward. This was not a question of whether or not we provided incentives. We provided the largest incentives in the history of Montgomery County. The state stepped up. We all stepped up and realized that this was important, and we made a gallant effort to try to reverse this. But at the end of the day, this was a very, very tough business decision based on the changes that we see now that are happening in the television and media industry.
We have a caller, Scott, in Silver Spring, who has a question on this same issue. Scott, you're on the air.
Thank you. And thanks, Ike, for your leadership and your service to the county. It's been an amazing ride. I was just wondering, it's such a huge employer moving and such a great building. I know the FBI has been looking for a long time for a place to move to, and that was kind of scotch. They were going to move to PG County, but wouldn't that be a great location for the FBI to move to? And have you thought about pursuing that?
We're pursuing everything on the board in terms of trying to make an effort to ensure that we get a big entity there. I've heard a great deal from a number of people about the FBI. I think they're coming out with a new perspective now to look at where they would hope to be located. Based on what they provided earlier, it almost ruled out many of the locations in Montgomery County. But I think they've made some adjustments to that, and we're going to be looking at that as well as a number of other entities around the region.
They're also looking at more of a fortress place where I don't think the Discovery Channel in the heart of Silver Spring would be what the kind of place they want. It is the same amount of square footage, about 550,000, that Amazon says it needs to start a move to a second new headquarters.
As I said before, we're looking at everything on the board. We have a very strong proposal in for Amazon at several locations in the county, but this could be one of the backup ones as well.
Let's hear from Mindy in the district. Mindy, you have a question for Montgomery County Executive Ike Leggett.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much. Mr. Leggett, this is a question that Paul Wiedefeld could have answered as well, but I'd like your views. The Metro sometimes is host to homeless people who are on the train simply because there's nowhere else to go. I just encountered someone yesterday. Do you have any thoughts about what can be done? I did go to someone in the kiosk, one of the station managers. He said there was nothing they could do. But surely someone can do something. Any suggestions?
Well, we've had an ongoing outreach program in Montgomery County, especially along the route of the Red Line. In Silver Spring near Progress Place, so that we are taking people, especially during the time of this very inclement weather, to try to get them in locations that are better. To the degree that we have people on the buses or on the trains themselves, we'll try to look at that as well. But we've actually taken people off the street, placed them in some of the facilities to order to avoid the challenges you see with people constantly riding because they have nowhere else to go. But thank you for your question.
We just got word, Ike Leggett, that the Maryland State Senate just moments ago passed the paid sick leave bill, overrode Governor Hogan's veto. And so with 30 votes, that is now law in Maryland. What will this do, and what does this say about what we were just talking about, how powerful and popular Governor Hogan is? Here he is being overridden on kind of a signature issue.
Well, certainly it means congratulations to the Senate and the House yesterday, but it also means that we need to continue to elect more Democrats so that we can, in fact, override some of these vetoes, and that's very important. Keep in mind, not only are you electing the governor next term, but you're electing a number of members to the House and Senate as well. This will be a great deal for families, especially those who are in trouble because they have to make this very difficult choice between whether or not to go to work or stay home to take care of themselves or someone else. And I think the Senate and the House did the right thing.
Just be clear that this law would require any company with 15 or more employees to have 5 days a year for the employees. Governor Hogan attempted to change that. He wanted to go to any business with 25 or more employees. It wasn't that far apart, but it does involve thousands of workers.
In November, Ike Leggett, the County Department of Finance discovered that the county had a $120 million budget shortfall. And this was a bit of a surprise because there had been an incorrect projection of the county's revenue. What happened there, and what are you doing to address that?
I'm not sure it'll be an incorrect correction, a mistake been made, but here's what we best have been able to determine thus far. We recognize that a number of taxpayers at the high level in Montgomery County, in Howard County, in Baltimore County, in Talbot County, that the tax revenues based on the projections went down in those four jurisdictions. Those are the more wealthy jurisdictions in the state of Maryland. In Montgomery County, we saw a drop of, I would say, about $1 billion in what would have been normally reported income not reported in Montgomery County. And that represented, believe it or not, just 50 people. And so as a result of that, our conclusion was that around the state in these very wealthy jurisdictions, based on the anticipation of the changes of the law at the federal level, that those people were held making purchases or they were held selling businesses and stock and capital gains. And as a result of that, in those very wealthy jurisdictions around the state, something unpredicted, that's what we think was the primary rationale for that. We're still evaluating that. We are looking at try to find ways in which to overcome that. I've just submitted a revised budget plan to overcome that offset of revenues. That's what we believe happened thus far.
Yesterday, this program discussed the term limits in the campaigns in Montgomery County for county executive and the at-large council races. It's quite some turmoil, I think. Andrew Metcalf from Bethesda Magazine talked about it. You both have term limits now, and you have public financing. You're leaving the office. What are you thinking as you look at what's happening in Montgomery County?
Well, I think on one hand, it's a great opportunity because you have a number of incumbents who will not be running for office for re-election. On the other hand, you also have, in addition to that, you also have the campaign finance, public financing that provides a great deal of finance to candidates running. And so people see a great deal of opportunity, and as a result of that, we have probably more than 30 people that are running at large, and a large number of people are running the district races. It's an exciting time in Montgomery County. It's a little bit confusing, and I think all of it will settle out. Maybe some of those candidates ultimately may not run come the filing deadline in February. But when you look at it, this is what democracy is about, and this is what elections are.
What do you think is actually going on there? Is this a direct result of the public financing that makes it easier for people to enter politics and to run for office? Is this a part of the Trump reaction that where people are getting more involved in the grassroots level? How do you
analyze? I think it's a little bit of both. The Trump reaction certainly in the number of people, and especially with female candidates running, a large number of females. But it's also the fact that for the first time in a very long period of time, you have a large number of incumbents that are not running. It's very difficult to beat incumbents in Montgomery County. And, of course, you could get public finance. So the combination of all of those things are having a real effect on the number of people running for public office.
So you've got a lot of work to do before you leave office at the end of 2018. But what are you going to do?
I indicated that I'm going to retire. What I do,
but retire. What does that mean?
That means that I'm
surrounded
going to
by
travel.
Retirees here.
That's right. That means that I'm going to travel. It means that I'm going to do some writing and research and spend a little bit more time with the family, and also take care of my health as well.
But before you do that, you have some difficult decisions to make. You've proposed cutting $25 million from the county's public schools budget, $5 million from Montgomery College. And that's got some people upset. Why are the largest budget cuts coming from the public schools?
Well, we've funded public schools at record numbers for a number of years. And when you look at our K-12 and Montgomery College, that's 60% of our budget. And so as a result, anytime that you're looking at cuts, you're going to have everything on the table. If we don't make these adjustments now, that means in just a couple of months we'll make even larger reductions, because the 120 that you just talked about doubles in a couple of months, so it comes close to 250. So I do not intend anticipate that there will be a significant change in our revenue patterns. There's no hope of having any type of increased revenues from taxes to go deep into our reserves in order to resolve this. I think would be a huge mistake. And so everything needs to be on the table. We will look very carefully at every aspect of the budget, but you cannot keep in mind the following. When you look at the budget itself, 60% of that is tied up in education, college as well as K through 12. 11% is debt service. That's your paying your mortgage payment. And then about 12% or 10-11% of that is tied up in public safety. So it only leaves a very small amount left beyond that. So if you're to not involve education in that, you'd have to devastate libraries, the health and human services, housing programs, support for the poor across the board. So for us, education is such a large part of the budget, and it must be on the table, unfortunately, in order for us to resolve the challenge.
Transportation, to me, is the number one issue in the region, not just Metro, but just the traffic nightmares that you see but from Virginia into Montgomery County. Is there anything that Maryland, Virginia, and the district can do to make business flow better by fixing some of these traffic issues? I mean, my view is they should enforce rush hour rules, which the city doesn't do sufficiently, but your own view and traffic there on Connecticut Avenue, Wisconsin Avenue, River Road, and all out into Montgomery County up into Rockville.
Well, first of all, I think that there's a regional problem, as you've just addressed it, but I think we need to get more people out of the automobiles and into public transit. That's why I believe so heavily in what I stated earlier about support for the metro system and why we need to enhance that. We are looking very carefully in Montgomery County at bus rapid transit and a number of other transit options, and we need to do that as a region because we simply cannot continue the pattern that we're going.
And Purple Line's en route.
Yeah, that's good news, I would imagine. The Purple Line now moving forward. We just have a few seconds left, but when can people actually expect to be riding the Purple Line?
I think it'll be a few years. We're looking probably at 2021.
I hope you will still be in your retired self, ability to still ride the Purple Line.
I hope so. We'll be there.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's also a columnist with the current newspapers, and our guest is Ike Leggett, the Montgomery County Executive. Thanks to both of you, and thanks to you for tuning into the show today. Join us Monday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, for a conversation about Black Lives Matter and King's legacy and how the way MLK Day is celebrated can obscure the more radical aspects of the movement today. We'll also look at the history and future of MLK Avenue in Washington. You can find all our shows at kojoshow.org and catch up on the go by subscribing to our podcast. You can find us at iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your favorite shows. I'm Mark Fisher of the Washington Post, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. Thanks very much for listening.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Inga-Lisa Strobstorff, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, and Avery Kleinman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.